This week, investors cheered the best national unemployment number in nearly two decades. Good news for the precious metals and U.S. equities. Well, welcome back, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek, here. We've got another big show. Two more top industry insiders on this May 5th episode. Have you heard of Ethereum? What a week it had. You might say it is crypto silver to Bitcoin gold. Ethereum is the Turing complete cryptocurrency. That's just fancy lingo that people can write and create their own scripts, giving Ethereum much more versatility than its nearly $10,000 big brother, Bitcoin. So what's going on with Ethereum? Well, there's so much. Obviously, it's been the ERC-20 token of choice right on the Ethereum blockchain, used for ICOs and issuing new companies in 2017. It was the go-to token and remains so, especially outside the United States. But what I'm convinced, though, is the big trend here, the big untold story, are crypto collectibles, digital collectibles. I started on it last week. I gave you a taste of what's coming. And with the Alpha Stocks newsletter, we have a crypto collectible for you. All new one-year subscribers will receive a crypto kitty, not just any kitty. This is with some of the favorable characteristics like orange soda or Himalayan googly eyes, usually 3 to 4 generations. So none of this 5 to 12 or 16 generations, all really high quality crypto kitties. We're giving them away for a very limited time, probably be gone, frankly, by the time this posts. We'll actually send it to your wallet. Your Ethereum wallet can breed them, or you can hodl them if you like, which is what most people are doing. They're on a big discount here, and I don't think they will be for long, with some trading as much as $2,500, just the beginning of what will be at least a $10 billion industry. We're only maybe $10 million into it, so this looks like 1,000x from here. That, I think, is the big story. Turning to this week's two big guests, Wolf Richter returns to the show, founder of WolfStreet.com, notes cautionary comments on the U.S. financial sector. He doesn't expect the markets to implode, but he is looking for really subdued growth in paper assets. Although not really a professed gold bug per se, he does see portfolio balancing qualities of gold and silver. He's very concerned by the housing market, and I share his concern. The FHA, Freddie Mac, and Fannie Mae have essentially created an echo bubble by hiding the subprime, not actually calling them subprime loans, but offering 3 to 3.5% and virtually no down payment and almost no check at all on employment. So it looks to me like we have an even worse situation unfolding. So I think that's going to be a big, big problem on a forward basis. And we may not see quite the depth and the severity of the housing bust that we saw in 2006 through 2009. But I do see ominous clouds ahead, especially amid higher rates. There's just too many negative signs here. It's sort of a cautionary moment for homebuyers and those who have been speculating or flipping. And also, I'd like to mention the Tezos pre-token future. Futures look like they're ready to pop another 50%. Of course, full transparency, I do have a few of these, very small position, but the technical position is very strong here. So Tezos, that's the pre-token futures. It looks like it's in great shape. And then there's the ITZ. It's back down to buy levels to just a few pennies. It was up at, I think, around 50 cents a couple of months ago. I see 25X in its future. Of course, very speculative, not investment advice, but I'm giving 100 away along with the crypto kitty to all new subscribers. You can help keep us on the air here. You know, we really rely on your support. Free 100 ITZ tokens in your name. And one crypto kitty of your choosing. Whatever we have left in stock, keep in mind it's going quickly, but we'll make sure you get one. And of course, Peter Kendall makes his debut here on the show. He's the co-editor of the Elliott Wave Financial Forecast. Everyone will remember Robert Prechter. Elliott Wave Institute is actually just down the highway here, about 40 minutes from this studio. Big shout out to Robert Ian, a key component of this show now for over a decade. It's his 23rd anniversary, so we just want to send a big congratulations to them. I know everyone really appreciates his tireless efforts to try to keep this show relevant. So, Robert Ian, congratulations, 23 years. remarkable. My wife and I have been together just over a decade. And three cheers for another 23 years. And the Q&A hotline, 641-715-3900, followed by extension number 514049. 641-715-3900, followed by extension number 414049. We'd like you to call in, leave your questions and comments. You can do so 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we'll get to them and answer those for you on air. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Partly sunny skies persisted over the precious metals sector amid a three-week-long dollar rally on stronger-than-expected employment numbers. Plus, robust domestic inflation added support under the precious metals safe haven, which shed just $9, about 1%, ending at $13.14, still well above support. Silver picked up 2 cents, finishing at $16.52, while the XAU Precious Metal Shares Index relinquished about half a dollar, ending at $82.40. Black gold finished near break-even at $69.72, a multi-year record, well above consolidation support, and still on track to our $70 forecast easily, and likely much higher. But I think we could see $100 from a technical perspective. And on to Bitcoin. The Bitcoin ETF, GBTC, holding up very well, adding about 10 cents, less than half a percent, treading water around 1560, but looking very solid in the chart, up over 40% in just the last month. The top story moving the markets, employers added fewer new employees than expected to the payrolls, according to the April U.S. employment report from the Labor Department. Non-farm payrolls inched higher by 164,000. That was well off economists' forecast of 195,000. However, the overall national unemployment rate dipped by 0.1% to 3.9. That was the best figure since the year 2000. Softer numbers suggests that Fed officials might just be less hawkish on the overnight lending rate. Plus, the February employment figure was revised down to 324,000, while the March employment data was up to 135,000. The CBOE Fed Funds futures showed 100% odds of a rate hike at the June FOMC meeting and higher odds of a final rate hike at the end of the year. Currently, my call for only two more rate hikes seems like the most likely outcome. I don't see any chance of three more hikes by year end. In other news, a statement from the U.S.-China trade meeting in China this week noted new agreements were made and significant disagreements over certain issues persisted. The news came on the heels of the ongoing trade war between the West and the BRICS nations, particularly China. The U.S. gave the nation a list of demands, according to one media report, including the reduction of the bilateral trade deficit by at least $200 billion by the end of 2020. In related news, on Friday, New York Fed President William Dudley said he's happy where we are today on inflation, and he doubts the U.S. will enter a recession in the next 2 years. One can't help but wonder, though, given that the yield curve has officially inverted. And in many instances over the past few decades, whenever this occurs, in about a year, a recession unfolds. So one can't really wonder if Mr. Dudley is aware of this and is watching it closely. Precious metals, bottom line, and Bitcoin. Well, the three-week explosive rally in the U.S. greenback should have just crushed the precious metals. But the fact that it didn't, instead the XAU shares index actually moved higher, I think is bullish. Plus, this nearly exact same gold chart pattern unfolded in 2009 just before we doubled in price and ran to 1900, didn't stop running for 2 years. I mean, it is virtually identical to the 2008-2009 Great Recession. Stay tuned. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, partly sunny skies persisted over the New York Stock Exchange as investors added a few shares on better-than-expected domestic numbers. By Friday's close, most of the indices were near break-even or better. The Dow Jones was off only 49 points, while the S&P 500 was off fractionally down 6 points at 26.63, and the NASDAQ added over 1%, bucking the trend, picking up 90 points and closing at 72.09. That's 2,200 points above its year 2000 dot-com peak. On Wall Street, all 11 S&P 500 sectors were higher at one point, with the high-flying technology sector leading the charge, adding almost 1.5%. U.S. stocks rallied late Friday, with major indices ignoring the early downturn. Apple Inc. adding over 4% on news from CNBC that Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett's baby, bought 75 million shares of the iPhone manufacturer in the first quarter of this year. The stock hit a new record and is on track for its biggest weekly gain in over 7 years. And it's been an Alpha Stocks newsletter favorite, folks, for many years. Plus, Newell Brands, NWL, added 3%, 3.5% to be exact, on better-than-expected first quarter earnings, and on news that it would sell off a laggard component. But it was Alibaba, BABA, that looks so good technically in the charts, 4.46% higher. The Chinese e-commerce giant posted record fourth quarter revenue and earnings, looks solid. Celgen, CELG, added over 1%. The biotech company had better than expected first quarter earnings and provided really solid earnings guidance. And another hot one, Berkshire Hathaway, BRK.A and BRK.B shares were up over 2%, and frankly, from a technical perspective, not advice, but looks incredibly solid in more or less, I think, a proxy for the overall market. Pandora Media exploded 21%. Actually, it was almost 24% at one point late Thursday, but it looks a bit toppy in the near term. GoPro was up 11% after its news, better than expected earnings. And Shake Shack Inc., SHAK, was up about 20%. It's also a bit overextended on news that this burger chain posted better than expected earnings. U.S. shares, bottom line. Well, as forecasted in the last two reports, U.S. stocks retested support and rebounded sharply. The 7 indicator USA Today Greed to Fear Index pendulum remains in the fear category. This, of course, very positive indicator that the herd is nervous, which makes the professionals calm and ready to act with tons of wiggle room for higher prices. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek Radio. Today's featured guest, the head of WolfStreet.com. Welcome back, Wolf Richter.
Thanks for having me back, Chris.
You know, it's a pleasure to have you. And what really drew my attention to send the request to you, an article you penned on the housing bubble, the U.S. domestic housing market might be rolling over, brought up some compelling evidence to support this thesis, the graphs of the Case-Shiller Index in the more bubbly cities. Why don't you tell us more, please?
Yeah, so housing is very local. So every market has its own dynamics, and they all look very, very different. So if you look at the national averages, it really, they average out the dynamics on the ground. So you can have one enormous housing bubble in one market, and you have a downturn in the other. And on the national basis, it might look kind of reasonable as it's averaged out. What I like to look at is among the big markets, so the big and expensive markets that we have in the United States, how are they doing? And some of them, many of them actually, have now surpassed by a very large margin the home values, the peak of the prior bubble. And let's remember, the peak of the prior bubble wasn't a state of calm or some kind of normal, that we want to go back to. It was the peak before it all collapsed. And so now we're in many of these markets, we are substantially above that prior peak. And a lot of people say, well, okay, so now we're finally back. We're healed where we used to be. It's not a healing process. That's a bubble process that has now exceeded the prior levels. And on a national basis for the Case-Shiller index, their national index is now about 7% higher than during the peak of 2006. And that averages away a lot of the big cities. The movements have been much, much sharper. Some of them, like Boston's up about 13% from the peak in 2006. That kind of is explained by, the rise in the household incomes, those kind of things. We did have some of that. We had some inflation since then, and there's some rise in incomes also. When you're up 13%, 15% in that range, you're kind of given the current incomes and the current inflation levels, you're kind of back where you were in 2006, 2007, in that range. It means we're back at the peak of the prior bubble. We're not much above it. We're not really below. We're just right back. So that's what Boston is. Boston is right back where it was in 2006, 2007, after inflation and after wage increase. Seattle looks a little different. Seattle is 24% higher than during the peak of the bubble before. And, you know, Seattle had a phenomenal bubble beforehand. And so now it's 24% higher than that. So that transcends any definition of inflation that we stick to in terms of CPI and the Fed's PCE. I know that personal inflation tends to be much higher. And if you consider the true cost of housing, the housing cost increases, it'll be significantly higher. But so Seattle is up there, 24% above the prior bubble peak. Now, Denver is nearly 50% above the prior bubble peak. And that, you know, I know some people who live in Denver, and they watch this happen, and price increases are incredibly sharp. Now, this is the Case-Shiller Home Price Index. It's not median prices or average prices. This is based on home sales pairs. So they look at how one house sold in 2011, and then they look at the price when it sells in, you know, in March, and they apply algorithms and other formulas to figure out what the home price increase on that particular home was for that year. It's a different method of looking at it, but over the long term, it's a somewhat more conservative measure than, say, the median price, which can be influenced by a change in the mix. So if you have more expensive units selling in a particular month, you know, that increases the median price, even though the actual prices of each individual home isn't increasing. And average prices are very, very much influenced by one home, a $50 million home selling in the market, and it moves the entire market up. The indexes we're talking about now, they're not median, not average. It's based on sales pairs. It's a pretty conservative way of looking at this. And in Denver, yeah, those prices are now 50% higher than they were during the peak of the prior bubble. In Dallas, it's 44%. Dallas has had an enormous, and that's not the city of Dallas, but Dallas-Fort Worth metro area, and it goes into North Texas, they have had a phenomenal boom since the prior housing bubble. Atlanta, of course, it's another one of my favorite places because it has a perfect V-shaped recovery. I mean, it was one of the famous housing bust cities, and where home prices really collapsed, surged before, then collapsed, and they have resurged. Atlanta is now above the prior peak also. Portland, another bubble city, they had a phenomenal bubble during housing bubble one. Now in housing bubble two, they're 21% above the peak of the prior bubble. And that's, now San Francisco, where I live, is a special case. Now that's the most expensive housing market in the country in terms of a metro area. This is the indexes for the 5-county area for San Francisco that includes the northern part of Silicon Valley. It includes part of the East Bay and includes part of the North Bay. So it's not just the city of San Francisco. It's a fairly large area. Home prices here are just outrageous. I mean, it's such a handicap for employers bringing in people. I talk to people all the time about that. They get job offers to come to this area and they can't accept them because they can't afford the home prices and they can't afford the rent. I mean, you're making $250,000 a year and you can't even buy a starter home with that. So it's that kind of proportion. And in San Francisco, where the housing bubble one has been just breathtaking, yeah, we're now 33% above the peak of the prior bubble. These housing bubbles run into problems with affordability. And in San Francisco, we call it the housing crisis. It's not a crisis of availability. There's tons of stuff available. It's just too expensive and people can't afford it. So it's an affordability crisis. It's a crisis of price inflation. And there's a reality to that. In the stock market, you don't have to eat stocks and you don't have to live in them. So they can kind of take on really absurd levels. In housing, that's not really the case. And so you run into the problem where people can no longer afford those home prices, and then eventually volume drops and eventually prices will drop. This is a situation that comes to a background. I mean, it was on the background of dropping mortgage rates. The mortgage rates have been dropping for many years, and they go up and down, but they've been on a downtrend for a very long time. They have turned around. So now today, we just got the latest number from the Mortgage Bankers Association, and mortgage rates, the average 30-year fixed rate that they processed is 4.80%, which was briefly the highest rate was in 2013. And now we really have to go back to 2011 to get rates this high. The 15-year rates are already back where they were in 2011. and the FHA backed mortgage rates are also back there. So we're looking at mortgage rates of the type that we've had in 2011, and we're looking at home prices that are 30-40% higher than they were then. How much longer can this continue? Clearly, the market is going to run into a real problem.
Thank you for that very thorough analysis. And if we're looking at an echo bubble, a housing echo bubble here, what would you point to as the key underlying causes here? If we go back to 2005, 2006, clearly we had the subprime, the Alt-A, and many other schemes that led to huge liquidity. Anyone who could fog a mirror could buy a mortgage, and that just fed upon itself. Fast forward to today, we don't have quite the same subprime, Alt-A, and other ninja loan issues. However, we do have student loan debt crisis on the horizon, credit card debt crisis on the horizon, and we have a huge number of hedge funds that have purchased up large swaths, if you will, of our real estate locally, regionally, and even across the country. Can you speak to what you believe we'll look back at as the cause of this second echo bubble?
And that's a very important question you're asking. And one reason for that are the extraordinary low interest rates that we've been experiencing. In 2012, I was just talking to people, you know, they bought some rental property back then, and they financed at 3.5%, 30-year fixed. When you think about that, that makes the home purchase or the investment property purchase very cheap if you finance it on a monthly basis. You know, and then back in 2012, that was after the housing crash, so prices were a lot lower. So those were good deals. Today, you'd have to finance the same home at 4.8%, and the price is 30-40% higher. So when we have an interest rate that consistently drops for, you know, it's been dropping for like 30 years, essentially. And mortgage rates have started dropping in the early 1980s. They have meandered lower until I think 2016 was probably the historic low point in that range. You know, so 2014, there's a dip there. Yeah. And so I don't think we'll revisit those levels again, ever again. I think that was part of the 30-year bull market in bonds and mortgage rates trade like them. They're converted to bonds in many cases, mortgage-backed securities, and so that it's all related. And I don't think we'll revisit that. I think those are finished. We're looking at higher mortgage rates. And that drive down there to get to these ultra-low mortgage rates, and the Fed encouraged that through its QE program. The Fed bought a couple of trillion worth of mortgage-backed securities to repress these mortgage rates and make home buying cheaper. And so when you make the cost of something, the monthly cost of something cheaper, you know, you're going to get more demand for this. And then it generates this whole cycle of home prices only go up. Now it's a good time to buy. You can get the investors to plow in. And it creates a mentality where you can't lose money in real estate. And that's where we are now. You know, now I constantly hear that you can't lose money in real estate. The last time I heard that was like in 2006 and 2005. So these ultra low interest rates have largely contributed to this. And then, yeah, the force of investors flying into this market is, domestic investors. So like you pointed out, hedge funds and PE firms that have bought a large stock of single-family homes out of foreclosure and to put them on the rental market. I mean, that's been a huge move. We now have landlords that have 45,000 single-family homes spread around some of the major markets, and there are several of them that have gone public, you know, so you can buy their shares that they're become REITs. So this is billions of dollars that securitize the rental payments, so that Wall Street has really jumped on this. And that's been going on for years, so that's really financialized the whole housing industry. You know, it's financialized what used to be just a place to live, and it's now just a global asset.
When you talk about securitizing payments, brings to my mind MBS, the mortgage-backed security, and the credit default swap, CDS disaster, where you brought up housing can never do anything but go up. When that becomes the ubiquitous mantra, look out below.
Yeah, securitizing rental payments, that's a new thing. They started in like 2014, 2015. And so we have no history on this. We don't know what that will do in the next crisis. People leave their homes, you know, and then their vacancies. Securitized products then begin to fail and lose money. They're in portfolios of pension funds and spread all around, institutional investors and so forth. I mean, This is not focused on banks now. This is focused on investors. And so in a sense, I think talk a little bit about the Fed here. The Fed's worried about the banks. And so the Fed's not worried about these rent-backed securities blowing up. You know, they're private hands, they're in pension funds, so when they blow up, it's not going to be a concern for the Fed, so the Fed's not going to try to bail them out. Yeah, the Fed gets worried when banks are involved. The mortgages the banks have done are in pretty good shape. I mean, that banks have quite a bit of capital. They have really been pretty critical of how they look at mortgage paper, and it's pretty pristine what they have, you know, and they have sold off that part of their risk too. What the problems we now have is these non-bank lenders have jumped into that market, and some of them are Quicken Loans has now become the biggest mortgage lender in the country, bigger than Wells Fargo, and they're not that regulated. The Fed doesn't regulate them, you know, they're not banks. And they obtain the money not from deposits, but from issuing bonds and from securitizing the mortgages that they originate. They do subprime mortgages, and their primary business model is growth. So they don't really worry that much about risk. Many of them were born after the financial crisis. So again, we don't have any history on some of them. And that's where the risks lie this time. It's not the banks. You know, this time it's going to be the non-bank mortgage lenders. That's where the risks are. That's where the subprime is. That's where the sloppy underwriting is. Fintech companies are that use other methods to check out borrowers. I think the rent-backed securities, they'll cause some damage in pension funds, and so the Fed will ignore it. Mortgages will cause some real damage in these non-bank lenders, and the Fed will ignore it. And so in other words, this time the Fed will not step in to stop a decline in the housing market, because the banks aren't at risk. And I think that's a very critical thing to think about. It was last time the Fed stepped in. And so people learned that and thinking there's a Fed put on this. You know, the Fed's going to step in when housing drops too far. And it looks like since the risk has deviated away from what the Fed is in charge of, the Fed's going to let this happen. You know, if it's happening slowly enough, if it doesn't freeze up the credit in the overall economy like it did last time, if it doesn't impact the banks, the Fed's going to let this thing slide.
So the implications, though, are profound when you add in the semi-bubble we've seen in U.S. shares and equities prices, and then the 30-year at least bubble in, of course, the bond bubble, all of which are somewhat interest rate sensitive.
You look at what Apple just announced, the enormous amount of share buyback. Now, they're bringing all this cash back. So there's a huge amount of money after all this money printing. You know, there's a huge amount of money out there, and some of it is overseas that's not coming back. So I think what will happen is that this money will keep coming into the market. And so the market goes down, and then this money comes back in and props it up a little bit. You know, and so we have this volatility that we've been seeing in the stock market. There may be a downward bias in the volatility. So it may go up and down and up and down, but down over the longer term. But I don't really see a major crash that could trigger, in terms of the stock market, that could trigger a nasty recession. There will be a recession in the United States. It may be a fairly minor one. You know, it may not be a big one, because until all this cash goes away, you know, this is going to come in. There's people waiting for these opportunities. You know, the hedge funds set up and there's companies set up to benefit from any small decline in asset prices. And they're going to prop this up. So if we have a downturn in the economy over the next year or two, I think in terms of the damage done to asset prices, it's going to be fairly minor at this point. My real worry is that this will drag out for a very, very long time. A tradable event like it was last time, it'll be over, you know, it'll be a year, and then you can really buy at the bottom. You know, fear I have is that this will meander lower for many years.
So do you see then housing returning to the mean? If we look at the overall Case-Shiller index,
Not because it's not possible, but because there's too many people waiting for it. Kind of question whether that cat on the sideline actually exists, but there are people waiting for a downturn in asset prices. You know, you have the dip buyers jump in, and these are not retail buyers. You know, these are big hedge funds with billions of dollars. You know? And this is Apple now buying its own shares. You know, and they announced yesterday what methods they're going to use. They're going to time the market. You know, they're going to buy their own shares every time they dip. You know, Apple's going to buy its own shares. And Google is going to do the same thing, and Microsoft's going to do the same thing. I mean, that's the share manipulation scheme that we now have. It's hard to have a really steep sell-off in that. You know, housing doesn't roll over in 3 months. You know, it takes many years for a housing market to roll over. Last time it took 4 years, and that was a crisis, you know, and that's 4 years. So, I mean, this housing markets can turn down for decades.
It's almost the case of if you can't beat them, join them. I mean, we're talking about Apple, some of these big names, the blue chips, if you will, in technology, the Dow and the S&P. And so it seems as though you expect this trend to persist, and why fight it?
I think there is a dip buying momentum here, you know. So I think the momentum is downward, but slowly, and it could be a very good trader's environment. And I was talking to a hedge fund guy yesterday, you know, and they're loving this because they need volatility to trade. And they now have that volatility. They can trade. You know, they might not make money on their trades, but at least it's moving, you know. And, but in terms of stocks, you know, that what we've seen so far this year, volatile, we're kind of back to normal. We just had a very low volatility period there for a while. Now the movement in percentage terms are kind of back to normal, but also, you know, the shares peaked in January 26th, and we really have not seen anything close since then. Yeah, I think this is an environment for traders because you're going to have a lot of movement. I don't know that a long-term investor can benefit from this market. You know, this is what I'm worried about. You know, I mean, I'm looking at Japan. You know, the stock market, you know, they're still halfway where they were in 1989. You know, so this stuff can get really, once you're in a bubble and you don't use inflation to demolish the currency, it may take a long time to work out of this, and it may not be a profitable game for a long time.
Didn't we see something similar to that after the dot-com implosion that arguably began year 2000 and culminated with the nadir of 2003? For nearly a decade, I don't believe any of the major indices eclipsed their former highs, and I think it took maybe even a little longer for the NASDAQ to return to its 5,000 peak. And so maybe something along those lines, just a decade of grueling backing and filling?
Yeah, I think that's a very plausible scenario. You know, the bond market, and we're talking about stocks, you know, stocks have been volatile. The bond market, outside of the short-term treasury end of it, the bond market is still in total bubble. You know, the junk bond market is incredibly bubblicious. And the junk bond market has never been as risky as it is now, you know, because companies have been able to sell bonds and sell other debt under the worst conditions for creditors, you know, for buyers. The contractor, we call them cov-lite, they've been getting away with it. So investors have a lot fewer protections when these companies default than they used to have. So the loss ratios will be much higher. At the same time, the yields are near record lows right now at the riskiest end of the triple C rated bonds. So that's the deep chunk. It's really in complete denial in that end of the market still. After all these rate increases and everything, the spreads between junk bonds and treasuries are near historic lows. It shows that, you know, people take enormous risks to just get a little extra return. You know, that's what the Fed is targeting. The Fed is saying, look, the risk premiums or the spreads are too narrow. They need to widen. You know, we need to increase interest rates, and we need to widen yield spreads. And so for the junk bond end, you know, that's going to be brutal to go through that. And we've seen that. I mean, the junk bonds have been an incredibly good investment since February 2016, and they're in total bubble area right now, and they have not moved off of that bubble area. They're still there, you know. So that will move faster than 10 years, you know, and you may never get back, because when these companies default, you know, your investment is going to get a haircut, and it, you know, that's going to be a different scenario than stocks. You can try to outweigh stock market drop, but once you own bonds, you know that if the company defaults, you're serious damage to your capital, and depending on what kind of bond it is, you know, that's the end of it. You know, the bond market, that's the biggest bubble we have, and it has not turned south.
But it looks as though U.S. shares will underperform. Bond market is extremely frothy, and heaven help those who have tried to chase higher yields with junk bonds. And housing also has signs of topping. We bring these three together, Wolf Richter. I mean, that comprises the majority of domestic investment. You're talking at least half of Americans have some stock bond exposure, and the rest have real estate. So we're not giving specific advice today, but are there any safe havens?
What we got to keep in mind is that investors have had it very good for the past 8-9 years, all around. I mean, except for precious metals, the last 5 years, you know, in terms of the other financial investments that we have, real estate, it's been incredibly good, whether it's housing or commercial real estate or stocks or bonds, whether it's mortgage-backed securities or term funds, whatever, you know, classic cars. Well, this stuff has been good. Some of it has turned around. Classic cars are starting to lose value, so that's no longer a great thing. Stocks have started to turn around. You know, bonds are still very strong. So I think overall, that 8 years or 9 years of good times will be paid for by bad times. And there's no way to escape that. You know, everything went up together, and it might go down together. There are right now, you know, in terms of precious metals, you know, they've been countercyclical over the last few years. You know, I'm not a fan of them. Their countercyclicality really makes them something that balances out a portfolio, and that's what you're looking for, you know. So they have not moved up with everything else. That doesn't guarantee that they won't move down with everything else, but at least they're not on the same parallel track. We also have short-term bonds now, so treasuries, for example, or FDIC-insured CDs, broker CDs that you can buy to your broker. You know, I've done three reports on that now because it's the first time I've seen that in 9 years. You know, 1 year CD is now offering over 2.2%, 2.25% in yield, and the banks are out there aggressively selling them. You know, that's the thing I haven't seen before since the financial crisis. Now banks are competing for money, so cash has value again, and this is just the beginning. So next year, a one-year CD, or, you know, you're looking at a treasury bill of the same type, you know, might offer 3.25%. And on these things, you don't make a lot of money, but when everything else is going down, capital preservation becomes a big priority. So if you have short-term treasury bonds or CDs, you preserve your capital, you don't make a lot, you know. And that at least helps balance out a risky part of your portfolio. You know, other than that, I mean, there's no way to rotate out of this in terms of bonds or stocks. You know, both went up together. Investors benefited from both. So there used to be a way to rotate from stocks into bonds and to mitigate your risk. That possibility doesn't exist today. And there used to be a way to rotate into real estate and mitigate your risk. And that doesn't really exist today anymore either. They all went up together. So we have to look at something else. And I think the good times are over. You know, having a portfolio that's broad-based and makes 20% a year, that's not going to happen anymore. You know, those times are over. So I think capital preservation is a good strategy now.
I think you've given us some excellent guidelines here today. I'd summarize buyer beware in most asset classes, but if you have to buy something, maybe consider beta balancing investment in precious metals to keep your portfolio afloat as cash becomes more appealing over the next few years. So tell people more, please, about Wolf Street and all of the neat stuff they can find there.
Yeah, wolfstreet.com. So this is like my name, Wolf, and Wall Street. So wolfstreet.com. Everything is free. We post about 2 or 3 articles a day, lots of charts and economic data. We stay out of politics, just business, economics, and finance.
Wolf Richter, please return in 2018.
Yes, we're looking forward to it. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to welcome Chief Analyst for U.S. Markets and Cultural Trends at Elliott Wave International. Welcome to the show, Peter Kendall.
Oh, okay, well, thanks for having me.
Let's jump right into stocks and precious metals. Clearly, we've seen a lot of increased volatility in U.S. equities this year. It's caught some investors off guard, maybe the more seasoned veterans, less so as so many pundits have been calling the top on this market since the 2009 nadir. Give us your take, please.
This word volatility is intriguing to me. It's intriguing to me particularly with relation to two people that are using it just recently. I guess it's Jack Bogle, Vanguard Funds. That's another stalwart, longtime veteran. But it's so interesting to me that they use the term because I think a lot of times the word volatility is used for down. The market is going down, and so they say it's volatile. Because the market is always volatile. It's always going up and down, but it's only when it's in a bear market that they say, well, we should expect volatility. It's like they don't want to say what they're thinking underneath, which is we might be in further declines. So, and in fact, that's where we think we are. So I guess I'm thinking, well, maybe these guys are baffled by the decline. And why would that be? Because we think it's a bigger decline than these men have even experienced. They've been around a long, long time, and yet there's something different about this. And then the waves actually confirm this. In the January issue, we showed a picture of what we call the throwover, which is right out of the textbook that Bob wrote with A.J. Frost back in 1979. In fact, in that book, he noted that he expected, in fact, in the final wave up, which is a cycle degree, it'll be the fifth of a fifth of fifth, you might get what is shown in the book as a throwover. Now, in the latest issue, which came out a few days ago, early April, we show that throwover, and we say, and we show the line that creates it, and we show that the market is now kind of has returned through the line as it described in the textbook and is now dancing around on that line. So it looks, you know, prototypically like what we would expect, in fact, right out of the textbook.
Let's move on over then to the precious metals. Things are looking up. We have very positive technicals across the board for gold. In particular, you might notice the interesting developments between paper assets and commodities. It looks like we are at a point where the pendulum could swing back in a much more favorable place for commodities relative to equities and related paper assets. Give us your take, please, on the commodities and in particular the precious metals.
I think it's possible that gold and silver will outperform the stock market, but it's going to be a relative thing. We do like gold right now. We think it's in a but. Caveat is that it's still a bear market rally. The potential is there for it to rise, but we don't think it's a steep rise. I would say the high of 2016 was around 1400 or 1399. We can get beyond that, but how far, I'm not sure. The choppiness of the rise from the early part of 2017 to confirm that we're in a counter trend rally in a bear market, and we'll get a C wave that finish all that up before we can get rolling to any great extent in gold.
But have you had a chance to look at the data showing the astounding excesses in paper assets relative to commodities, which, of course, the precious metals fall into the commodities sector? When you see this differential, I mean, one wonders when we'll be returning to the mean. Have you had a chance to look at any of the fundamentals, or are we just talking price?
Yeah, no, I'm not familiar with the fundamentals, but I could see the paper asset side of it, that's for sure, you know, the derivatives and the financial instruments that have become kind of derivatives of derivatives of derivatives at this point. I mean, futures started with the bull market in 1982 or 3 or so, and they just keep piling on one different type of paper on top of the other, of course, and then, of course, underlying much of it is a debt structure that is due for an implosion that gold will not experience because it can't. It's not paper. It's gold.
Let's talk about U.S. equities relative to gold. They tend to be negatively correlated, these two asset classes. Obviously, the love affair with equities remains intense. If the typical investor to start to look around for something a bit more tangible, a safe haven, there's a lot of topicality that would lead most investors to, you know, start searching for something a bit more solid when you start to hear about the potential for tariff and trade wars between our largest trading partners, not to mention potential conflict in Syria. Do you see a change in the themes and the typical investment themes that might be favorable for precious metals?
Well, we do see that change in the themes. The trade war is real. It will get more intense. The problem, at least initially, that we have within this bear market for the metals, precious metals, and metals in general, is that we think we're going to have a period of deflation in which, you know, people just have to raise cash to settle their debts or whatever. So that there will be pressure on, we call it all the same markets. We think there'll be across the breadth of the financial markets, we're going to see deflation like we had in the 1930s.
That's counter to everything we see here at Goldsea. Worst case, we would see a disinflationary environment. If we were to expect something like the 1930s, that, of course, would be a rogue wave, if you will, that very few folks would be expecting. This would be a multi-sigma risk event.
The prime analogy is 1930, when Smoot-Hawley passed in May of 1930. So, in a way, our point is, Well, guess what? This turn took place in January, and already within 2 months, we're seeing the very serious trade conflict between the U.S. and China. Now, it took a full 6 months or 8 months. It was the market topped in September of 1929. So that's 3-4 months plus 6 months. So it's 10 months before they took substantive action. In this case, it happens almost instantly. We think that's a first clue to the importance of this turn.
Firstly, the United States, our entire economic situation is a complete 180 from the 20s and 30s. I mean, we were not a debtor nation at that point. Plus, we were essentially on a gold standard. You could easily make the argument we did not have a true fiat currency in place. So the thought of a deflation makes a lot more sense from a purely notional derivatives perspective. Interest rate sensitivity that we have, that takes deflation, tosses it out the window.
Inflation just kind of bails everybody out. Deflation makes them have to pay it back in more and more dear dollars. So it's kind of like, you know, that's part of why we think this is the reality is a deflationary reality, because we don't see where people are going to get out of those obligations.
From my perspective, it would be more of a disinflationary period within a tidal wave, even a tsunami of inflation. What we're in right now is de facto in the cryptocurrency market, the greatest inflation since the Weimar period, maybe even since Hungary right now. However, within any slow motion or the initial stages of a global fiat hyperinflation, the likes of which the world has never seen, you can have periods of disinflation, which is what we saw, I believe, and most of my colleagues, in 2008, 2009. So again, if we were to see another period of disinflation, it could appear as though you were in a deflationary period. You would likely see the U.S. dollar rally.
I mean, you talk about Bitcoin. That's kind of an asset price inflation. In fact, the greatest asset price inflation in history. We first talked about it in 2010. It was at 6 cents. It was in the Theorist, Bob's publication, and he said that Bob's son wrote the piece, Elliot. He said Bitcoin appears to have enormous potential. We didn't talk about it too much. We talked about it here and there, and actually caught some of the different turns. And obviously, we all know what happened. It went to the moon. We got back into it really heavily in December of this year. We showed this, I don't know what we call it, an exponential curve. It just, by December, it had reached the very end of the line in other words, it was about to cross. And we said that when it does, a breakdown in this bowl-shaped formation will lead to a Bitcoin bear market that results in prices in double digits. And that's exactly what we think is transpiring now. And in February, we showed it breaking the bowl, and we said this decline is on.
What happened with Bitcoin, unlike most projects on Wall Street, which are funded and, of course, underwritten by deep pockets, Bitcoin was the first to completely sidestep Wall Street. You have most of Wall Street, of course, receiving shares of potential projects and companies at pennies or even less than pennies on the dollar. And by the time it reaches the market, you see that Google maybe opens at $80 on the exchange and runs. We believe something similar happened with Bitcoin. Why don't you tell folks more about what you do?
Again, thanks for having me. I'm in Gainesville, Georgia. You look us up on the internet, of course. ElliottWave.com. It's all laid out there for you. Just give us a call.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. A wise friend of mine once said, "He who has the most options wins." That's true in negotiations, conflict resolution, business, relationships, and pretty much life in general. The person with the most options wins. If success in any given situation is defined by only one specific outcome, the risk profile of achieving that success increases. But if there are 2, 3, or 4 potential scenarios that might create slightly different yet successful outcomes, your risk profile decreases and the likelihood of achieving that success expands across multiple scenarios. I was reminded of this concept recently while reading an article by Gary Christensen on his Miles Franklin blog, in which he eloquently summarized several key financial themes. We cannot borrow our way out of debt. We cannot spend our way into prosperity. We cannot tax our way into wealth. We cannot fix an excessive debt problem with more debt. And finally, unbacked paper money always returns to its intrinsic value of zero. Simple concepts for regular listeners of this broadcast, yet many others still fail to understand, refuse to understand, or simply ignore the realities behind each of these statements, ultimately at their own peril. Knowing full well the math behind each of these financial themes just doesn't add up. It is up to each of us to create multiple options in our own lifestyle, so that when one or more of these situations hits the fan, so to speak, we have a reasonable possibility of landing on our feet. No guarantees, just a reasonable possibility. Can you borrow your way out of debt? Not a chance. Can you spend your way into prosperity? No such luck. Can we tax our way into wealth? It has never happened. Can we solve debt problems with more debt? No, because interest rates eventually rise and the credit line eventually dries up. As paper money inevitably returns to its intrinsic value of zero, living standards and lifestyles will erode, robbing you of your time, your production, and your savings. When that happens, remember, in all likelihood, no one will be coming to the rescue. So prepare now, so you can prosper later. Because he who has the most options not only wins, but also survives. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. Thank you.
Thank you.